Public Safety of the Joint Ways and Means Committee meeting, May 19, 1987, 1:30 p.m., room H174.
Public Safety Subcommittee will come to order and will open a public hearing on House Bill 2053. Who wants to, not, that's not yours, that's Department of Energy. You want to confine your testimony to what on earth is this bill doing in Ways and Means, because we don't want to go through all of the E&E stuff. I left that behind me last session, don't want to do it again.
Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Ways and Means because as introduced, it would have increased the site certificate fees. As amended by House E&E, it has no fiscal impact. Basically does two things. For site certificate applications for major energy facilities, it clarifies the existing language to make sure that the applicant for the license pays the full cost of the state's review. Right now the words say they must agree to pay, and there's been some discussion about what must agree to pay means. So we would propose changing that to shall pay the full cost of the state review.
Okay.
The other aspect of the bill is it establishes for site certificate fees a penalty for late payments, a penalty of 2% per month. That's consistent with the penalty provision that we have for other fees paid to the department, and the purpose is to provide an incentive for folks to pay their fees on time.
Okay, thank you. Very good. Great, to the point. Mr. Kennedy, anything to add?
No, sir.
Very good. Anyone else care to testify on this bill? Then I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2053. Mr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, I think the bill has been accurately described to you. The only thing we would bring to your attention is that the penalty is consistent with the other penalties, but it is obviously above the current rates of interest and is intended to be a penalty for late payment as opposed to a alternative revenue source for delayed payment.
Okay, good. Anybody in this room unhappy about the bill? Representative Jones.
It would encourage timely payment.
I talked to one utility representative who has no problems with the bill, and he's nodding in agreement. Still doesn't have any problems.
Well, I don't have any problem with it, except that if you don't pay it, your interest is going to be more than your bill was, pretty close. At this rate.
Yes. Did you have? Nope. Okay.
Well, we want to move it out.
Sure. Senator Hannon moves House Bill 2053 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Objections? Hearing none. Carries. So we'll open up a public hearing on
yes,
House Bill 3381. Mr. Long, welcome back. I'm very pleased that you could make it today.
Thank you.
Sorry to disrupt your schedule, but sure we can proceed with what I think is a top priority bill.
Indeed it is, and it is the most important thing I'm working on. And also the most time consuming, I think.
Yeah.
I have about three or four things that I want to talk about, and then I'd like to have some other people from the Commerce Department present part of this to you. I want to pick up some sort of loose ends. First, with respect to the bank board.
Yes.
Mr. Kulongowski talked to Representative Phillips, and for the record, he indicated he had no objection to that amendment being withdrawn by whatever process is appropriate to do that.
Sorry.
Oh, that's all right. I was just mentioning, Mr. Chairman, that Mr. Kulongoski talked to Representative Phillips, and he authorized us to say that he has no objection to his amendment being withdrawn by whatever the appropriate process is, and if that facilitates your work.
Well, it sure does. Under House rules, we're required to consult with the chair of the House committee where the bill originated, and I did talk with Representative Shiprack, and he enthusiastically recommended deletion of that amendment, so I'm pleased to see that both the maker of the motion for the amendment and the chair are in agreement, so we'll go ahead and delete that.
Now, and we have the record show that both those gentlemen are great Americans.
And as Senator Harris points out, they're
great Americans.
We were talking about pawnbrokers last, and I'd like to just pick that up before I go to another subject. Here is, in the simplest terms, what the issue is there for us. Our opinion of the time spent on that rather small program, which I think there, and Mr. Pitt is here, I think there's about 13 licensed pawnbrokers in Oregon is all there is. What happens is that we get a lot of complaints. We get a lot of complaints about businesses that are not licensed pawnbrokers, and maybe they're secondhand merchants and so forth. And sometimes the complaints come from licensees saying, I think they're actually making loans, or I think they're doing something else. The program doesn't generate enough revenue to support the response to the complaints, and so it really has been living off the banking program, and the banking program is kind of starving anyway. So the suggestion we came up with was to abolish the program and leave regulation to local government. And there was some justification for that as follows. The law enforcement has a legitimate interest in those activities. Law enforcement in Oregon, for the most part, is local government based. In the city that I'm most familiar with, the city has its own ordinance, and it goes around and checks pawn shops and secondhand places as a matter of police work. So we thought maybe that would be a good idea, a good way to do it, just have local government do it, and because we couldn't justify the subsidy. We got back some complaints about our proposal in areas like in Portland where the city maybe has one policy and the county has another, and some of the businesses you're worried about are in the county, but it still looks like the city because the city is smaller than the metropolitan area and so forth. They said this will cause havoc for us because we can't really regulate. Well, I hadn't considered that. I understand the problem, and it's probably real. They came back to us, Paul Romain came on behalf of the pawnbrokers, and I met with one of the people. And we explored a number of different alternatives. I frankly have drawn sort of an economic line saying, I want to cooperate with you, but I don't want other programs to pay for that complaint activity. It's not fair in our judgment. Now, you may think it is or have a different point of view, but that's where we've drawn the line so far. I suggested they look for another home. Well, the trouble with that is, the other homes that have been suggested have been Justice and, you know, places like that. They make the same response I do. We don't want the program without any money. Finally, last week, a suggestion was made that I think we could live with, but I want to give you the full background, and I want you to sort of decide the question. I don't know that it's a tie vote, but it's pretty close. They came back and said, why don't you keep the licensing program, but amend the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to make doing pawnbroking without a license a consumer violation, so that we wouldn't have a complaint process and somebody else would have it. Well, that's a substantive law change. Frankly, if the legislature wants to do that, we you know, fine. We think it would be appropriate because that would take the burden of investigating complaints off us when we have no funds to do it with, and it would end the subsidy by the banks and the SNLs and the credit unions of the regulation of pawnbrokers. So there are the alternatives of, as I understand them. Find a new home, give it some money. I don't think you can raise enough money on 13 businesses to run a complaint process. You got to use some general fund money or some other method, or deregulate it as we suggested and mandate that local government perform.
Senator Hannon.
Mr. Long, I appreciate what you're saying because there are a lot of people out there having experiences firsthand last week, being called back home to Ashland late Thursday night and spending all day Friday and all day Saturday in so-called pawn shops in Clown Falls trying to retrieve personal goods that were stolen from our home the week before. But they all set themselves up as antique stores now. And they're out on South 6th, they're in Clown Falls. They're not regulated by the city because they're outside the city limits. They're not regulated by the county. And, you know, it was really a personal tragedy to have to go in there and try to search through all this stuff, trying to identify your own stuff. And it's the reason I've been late here today. I was on the phone talking to the detective again. Now they got murder and drugs and everything else tied up with the robbery of our house in Ashland. And I can assure you that if you would even be willing to, you have 13 pawnbrokers. I think these people set themselves up as antique dealers or secondhand stores. Every Tom, Dick, and Harry that wants to take goods from somebody, they need to be licensed, regulated, and controlled. Because if the county isn't going to do it, if the city isn't going to do it, the victim has to go in there and try to identify their own stuff. And then the people have the audacity to say, well, we bought this from a shipment 2 months ago from Bend. And the officer was with me and flipped out his badge and he said, I hate to tell you this, but this fellow was just ripped off a week ago. And it isn't the most pleasant feeling being raped. And I can have a better appreciation now of what it must feel like for a lady to be raped. Because to have $10,000 to $12,000 of personal mementos and family heirlooms and things that have been handed down over a long period of years, to lose that overnight, and I know maybe we put too much value in personal goods or material things, but I'd be willing to work with you and let us introduce a bill to take it out of you, take it out of the control, but let's put pawn shops, let's put these people in their regulatory function to generate the proper revenue that the banks and the SNLs don't have to subsidize it. I have no argument with you in the least. But I think, nonetheless, there needs to be a regulatory function somewhere. Someone has to be held accountable because you have 36 counties in the state, and you're going to have 36 different ordinances and applications of how they perceive it. You're going to have 260-some cities in the state on how they perceive it and want to regulate it. And I just think, and Mr. Chairman, I hope you don't mind me embarking on this, but I think that really, if you need to move it out for brokers, I would certainly be receptive if we don't abolish it and move it somewhere else in its own category, but bring some others in as well.
I think you said last time that, I don't know, 4 out of 5 people here have...
Three out of 4.
Well, you can make it 4 out of 6. I guess I'd say to you this. The pawnbroker regulation that's in Financial Institutions Division proceeds on kind of a thin philosophical basis right now. Proceeds on the assumption that we're doing it here because it's a loan program, $30 for your wallet, you know, that it's a small loan program. I mean, that's probably real to a certain extent. What you're talking about and what I can relate to from the days as a prosecutor is a criminal justice function. A criminal justice function to be able to have access to the books and records and obtain reports from used merchandise dealers, because we know from experience that that is an outlet for illicit goods, stolen property, etc. Well, if that's what we're going to do it for, let's put it in a criminal justice agency someplace, like the state police. I mean, they probably don't want to hear that, or some other, you know. Let's make it what you want it to be and not say it's a loan program, you know, the sort of miscast.
The only thing is it's late May.
I understand.
I got ripped off.
And I don't want to jeopardize this.
No, the point is, Senator Henry, I'm not ready to.
It can be neglected.
I'm not ready to deregulate it, though.
No.
I want to know how much they pay and how much the program costs. How about that?
Could I have the administrator come up and join us? You understand this is one of the smaller pieces of things that we presently do.
We found my wife's jewelry in a pawn shop in Albany. That's a fence, that's what it is.
I would like to find my grandfather's clock that was in his office and my father's and mine until it went along with some typewriters.
Did you find some of your possessions in a pawn shop?
Yeah, grandmother's glasses, early 1900 vintage, with all kind of fits in the bridge. And the officer said, this is a case. Can you identify the case before I even show it to you? And I said, yeah, it'll say doctors, maybe and maybe, ear, nose, and throat, Dr. Mitchell, South Dakota, on there. And he flipped it over, and that's what it had on there. And then these people had the audacity to say it come out of bed.
But wait till you get to the next part, which is after, you know, they use it as evidence. Then you're supposed to pay the pawnbroker fence money that they paid the crooks. That's really fun. Anyway, so we love pawnbrokers. You can tell.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Paul Arnson, administrator of the Financial Institution Division. There are 13 licensed pawnbrokers in the state of Oregon. The program generates $7,000 biennium in income and expense. Well, expense is substantially higher than that.
How much?
I just got a bill from the Attorney General's office for a portion of a case which was $4,000, and $1,500 of that was relating to pawnbroker regulation.
And that is a guess at an annual cost. Was it $7,000 income annual or biennial?
Biennial income.
Okay. And a biennial expenditure?
Double that.
Okay. How about doubling their fees?
Well, they currently pay $350 a year annual as an annual assessment, plus $30 an hour for the exam time. And the exam is strictly a compliance type of exam. It's not is this stolen or is this not stolen, or did you buy this from somebody or not by somebody. It's strictly looking at the pawn ticket, ensuring that the setup fee for the loan was properly computed, ensuring that when the person came in and paid off the pawn item that they got their goods back in a timely fashion. It's strictly, as the director pointed out, it's a loan operation. And that's our focus, is looking at the loan operation. The majority of our complaints come from from our licensees who are complaining about some guy up the street. Joe Dokes has got a buy and sell operation, and someone mentioned an antique store, and those folks do some pawning. We've got two cases now that we are in the process, which is where the Attorney General fees came from, of attempting to levy a civil penalty against two illegal pawning operations in the city of Portland, Multnomah County. We were told by the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office that there are probably 200 illegal pawning operations in the greater Portland area alone.
Well, that's what those people are doing in Klamath County. They're setting themselves up, signs as antiques. They're no more an antique dealer than I am a surgeon. And the problem is, they're setting themselves out and really looking as legitimate businesses, and all they are is just fences for stolen goods, and they're selling firearms. I'm pressing charges now against the clown that runs the antique store for selling one of my guns, because he didn't even have a firearms license to sell, and he doesn't even know who he sold it to.
Yeah,
and now it's come back to us today via the detective, also a murder's been involved with one of my own guns, and I'll tell you, I'm not gonna fry out there on State Street somebody else that's used my stolen equipment to do it with. If they want to do themselves in, more power to them, but not with my stuff.
Senator, we don't have a lot of problem with our licensed people. I mean, those are the legitimate, the Star Loan Exchange down on Court Street across from our office is one of the most legitimate organizations going. Their books are wide open. They have an excellent rapport with the local police department, the pawn shop detail. They have a full-time police officer assigned to that kind of activity. They get along very well, the books are wide open, there's no problems. It's not our 13 licensees, frankly, that are causing us the difficulty financially.
It's the ones that are unlicensed.
It's the 300 or 400 others around that are doing these buy-sell things, and
who's supposed to bust them? You? Is it?
Local police.
Local police.
Statutorily, we've got responsibility to investigate complaints.
So you get a complaint, and somebody says they're a pawn shop.
We proceed to write them a letter and say that you know, we've been told this is going on. We've gone up. We've looked at the pawn shop. We even hired a retired state police trooper and handed him an old beat-up typewriter to go in and made a case and cooperate with Multnomah County. The interesting, if I can just take a second on the side, the interesting thing was when we got ready to proceed with the civil penalty or to have the hearing, our Assistant Attorney General, Kathy Dahleen, we had three different names. We couldn't even find out who owned the business. We made a finding against an individual who we were told later doesn't exist. It's real sleazy. It really is. And it's a law enforcement function.
It's criminal justice.
I understand that. Well, but would you all mind administering it for a biennium or so until we can get a bill passed?
We can get some money from you.
Well, I think we ought to get it from them.
Problem is, Representative McCracken, that we can do it. We could double their exam fee. We could say $60 an hour, and we're going to double your license
fee.
And we could beat them in the head.
Yeah.
Problem is that the legitimate broker, they aren't making a lot of money. They're not. They're not making $100,000 a year. It's a small business. It's a mom and pop, literally, husband, wife, and brother-in-law kind of small business in Oregon. And to go through and double that activity has a real impact on small business.
Representative Jones.
Where did you propose to get it then?
Well, sir, we had proposed to get rid of them.
I know that, but it doesn't sound like you're going to get that done.
We will have to increase their fees. We will have to increase their fees substantially in order to do that. Or some increase in fees and then an understanding among our 13 licensees that we don't want to hear from them. We don't want to hear your complaints. Take it to someone else. Because then if we get the complaint, we are forced then to get into an investigative mode and
no way of bringing in the other 100 or 2 or 3.
Well, that we explored that, and you know, changing the definition of pawnbroker or changing the scope of the regulation to address the broader perspective is what ought to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a financial operation that's here in front of you. It just so happens that I have some experience in criminal justice. I mean, that's just fortuitous. That is a complicated and technical subject. The investigations are difficult. We don't have the expertise to do that. I mean, this program doesn't have that expertise, and I really question whether you'd want to build it here. I mean, wouldn't you really rather see it in the state police or someplace like that if you want to do it right?
Well, but that's long, though. If supposing that we turn it over to the state police and brought in these other people, which would give them, if you can bring them in, then that'd give them plenty of money. It would seem to me like we could change the definition to include the antiques or whatever and give it to somebody that's going to do the investigation anyway.
Yeah, you know, there are some models out there in local government of used merchandise dealer regulations, and that's what I think your response is. And it's usually a license requirement and a logging requirement and an inspection requirement, and that's how things are found. Police officers go in and write down serial numbers off cameras and get a hit with the computer. That's what happens. But we're not set up to do that.
Could I ask you a question?
Sarah Wires.
Procedurally, where are we? Now, you've gotten it out in a substantive committee.
Yes, sir.
And in getting it out, you didn't send it somewhere else. You just said it's going to be a local government thing. And so pawnbrokers will not be licensed by the state if this bill became law the way it is.
Yes, sir.
So if we think that was a bad decision, then we got to go back to committee in the House again?
No, let me clarify again. It's simply that the chair has to consult with the chair of the substantive committee. That's it. So there's no vote of a substantive committee at all, and the chair has been very cooperative because he knew he was rushed and did not give a thorough review of this, and I don't think there'd be any problem. You know, we're talking about quite a lot of statutes here to be repealed. I have them before me, and I'm just concerned about deregulating them in the absence of putting something in.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me the problem is there are two or three problems here. One of them is this would seem with a lot of people getting things stolen from right now to be a very politically sensitive time to get up and say there's a lot of people getting things stolen, so we decided to repeal the regulation of pawnbrokers.
Right.
I mean, that seems sort of, but I. what Stan Long is saying, I think if you get beneath the surface perception of this, there's really something there. But it seems to me if we were going to go that way, we ought to be able to say that there was something going to be better in the area of,
exactly.
of these shops. And I haven't heard yet a suggestion, and I haven't thought of one myself, of what we could do to build a fire under local government.
And you couldn't, because the Senator Hannon points out you'll have an operation that's outside of a city. And I think it's cities that generally have the ordinances that regulate the pawn shops. And trying to get Oregon's 36 counties, oh, brother.
Well, that's the thing, yeah, the thing, if we mandated that 36 counties do some kind of a, use the word logging. The thing I ran into, I got involved in a criminal prosecution about this once where I was defending the innocent bailee of this stolen gun, and I found out real fast that there's a tremendous difference between guns, you're probably learning this, between guns and, say, cameras, because there's a law. This guy apparently didn't comply with it, but I think most people who are dealing with used stuff, if they're at all ongoing with what they're doing, if they deal with guns, they get a gun license because they know they damn well better have those serial numbers. Or they can get hung. Yeah. But cameras, refrigerators, TVs, all that stuff, they're not required. I suppose it would be an incredible leap if we required them to take down some kind of serial numbers on cameras and stuff like that. But that would be the kind of thing that would really put some wing in
it. You might give a better definition.
Maybe. What do you could I ask a question?
Go right ahead.
What do you think, Mr. Long, about? Is there something you thought of that we could do so people would see that we weren't just saying, this isn't working, so we're going to quit doing it? Some kind of recording requirement or something that would be locally enforced.
That's why I thought that, I felt that perhaps continuing the registration program only for these loan operations, they're small loan operations, and that's the way I defend myself from some sort of anti-law enforcement allegation, which would be odd to levy given my own background, but continue a licensing requirement only. I think it is a real issue, and I wish I'd have been on it, you know, last January or February. I wasn't. I think it is an appropriate bill for the legislature to pass, creating a used merchandise statute and giving it to some place where you think would be appropriate in state government, and say you will record who you bought it from and what, and get a driver's license and so forth, and you'll make those records available. And then the agency where that program is housed can develop the computer response. That's really marvelous. And I can tell you stories from prosecution days about how things are. I mean, we even caught a police officer once who sold her own camera, having turned it into the insurance company as lost. And you know, we got it off the insurance company report and off of a used merchandise dealer check on the local ordinance and went bingo. You know, and uncovered a dishonest police officer. I mean, those kind of things are very real if you have the program. Eugene has one, the state doesn't.
Well, how about this? But how about we leave the licensing laws in there? I just read them, and you know, I'd hate to repeal those. It states what? Who should have a license and who shouldn't, and convicted criminals and so forth shouldn't. And, I mean, I would just hate to eliminate that statutory authority. Go ahead, double their fees for this biennium. Why don't we send a letter to the presiding officers requesting that an interim committee study it. I'm not saying that one would be specially appointed to do this, but an interim committee study, make recommendations. We'll tell their lobbyists to work sincerely with that committee to try to expand the definition of pawnbrokers so that we catch in that net the people who are acting, you know, in a pawnbroker type role and may also be fences, and get it fixed up kind of right instead of doing it at the last minute, if you don't mind.
Would you consider giving us some relief from the investigation of complaints and not raising the fees on these 13 small businesses?
Well, And just, so then somebody calls and complains, and then what do you tell them? Well, the legislature told us that we didn't have to do that anymore, so we're not going to respond to your complaint. Then they'll call us, I bet.
Well, amend the Unlawful Trade Practices Act and make it a violation of the consumer protection laws, and they can complain to the Department of Justice or seek relief themselves with attorney fees and all the process that's there. It really is a consumer issue in many respects. But that's a reasonable thing to do, and it's a short kind of an amendment.
Well, we ought to do that anyway. My bias is bigger than my chair on this, but it seems to me that you create a statutory cause of action in situations where fraud can be shown. It's a good idea, but it's only one piece of the whole thing. But then if Senator Hannon found something, I guess he can't bring an independent action that right now. He could for a conversion or something.
That's about it. And of course, the thing that really has the teeth is the violation of the federal firearms. Of course, I believe it to be a felony.
But on the other heirlooms that aren't guns, he always got a conversion action, which you've got to prove higher standard proof than the.
And then you got that common law wrestling match about whether you have to pay the person who dealt with the thief. That case has been around a long time.
Services and supplies, and then you add back in the bank examiner's three, and you'll bank examiner three positions, and you'll notice as leave one vacant. The task force's belief and the belief of the people involved in the credit union industry is that there will be some growth in that area. One of the problems in the past that led to the difficulty that financial institutions was in was an overly optimistic projection about what was going to happen in the future. So the task force chose not to rely on any kind of growth figures in these areas, choosing instead to come up with a budget that we knew would not require another mid-biennium layoff or another mid-biennium cutback. And we can count on this revenue coming in. If, in fact, there's the kind of growth in the credit union area that we believe will occur, we'd like to have the position and the limitation, but not fill it unless there is that growth in the credit unions. There are other.
Put that on the wish list.
That's a little bit unusual. It's not unusual for you to leave an FTE unfunded in an agency, and then as they come up with the revenue, they come back to you, and you have a chance to look at it. But to leave both the FTE and the expenditure authority is a bit different than what you would normally do.
We try to bring variety to you.
I appreciate that.
Each time we come.
And I appreciate these little offerings. Makes us feel like we're doing something important.
Well, I guess in return, it's a little unusual to cut one fourth of your staff as well. So I thought we'd throw that in.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, the comparison here with FTE on page 3, we don't have a comparison. Could you tell us just roughly how many you're deleting from the positions? You got 41.
Representative Jones, the total appears on the next page about a third of the way down where it says 28. It's not totaled on page 3 because we started subtracting positions and then we added some more back in.
To answer my question, where do we start from back here? On 80 on page 3?
No, we start further down, Representative Jones, under about three-quarters of the way down, where we start with F, Financial Institutions mm-hmm. Division. It says Governor's Printed Budget 41.
You start with 41 there.
Right. And then the net task force adjustment is a reduction of 11 positions. And then due to the reorganization, which means the new department, we are subtracting a systems analyst and business manager and making the reclassification for the deputy and some of those things.
So just plainly speaking, we're from 41 down to 28.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And there were 43 present biennium when they started.
That's correct. The reductions simply based on financial institutions division revenue shortfall would have to be 11 positions in any event. The additional positions savings are achieved by virtue of the new department, where there'll be other services available through the administrative services of the Financial Institutions Division.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Weiners.
If you're going to offer as a way to reassure the public that by reducing the number of bank examiners, you're not really going to jeopardize the oversight, and you're going to soften, you're going to reassure the public by saying we're going to cross-train people that are using the model of paralegal, and you're going to keep time records and then pay the people, have you got anything to indicate that those new, the people you're going to have doing this, going back and forth, are going to cost enough less to argue that some measurable number of 13 lost people would be made up in terms of the hours that those 13 would have done versus the hours that these least less expensive people are going to be able to do, so we could get up on the floor or tell it in a meeting back in our district that we got 13 fewer people, but if you take the person hours that those 13 people will have done, they're going to be picked up, and so they're going to be at least 70% of the people hours that they were doing, or 80% or 60% will now be continue to be performed in terms of hands-on examination, or have you got that for us?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Weiners, I think the answer to that question lies partly in the capital outlay section of this budget. One of the things, the only place where the task force recommended an increase was in capital outlay, and that's to buy computer equipment so that these examiners will become more efficient. One of the things we learned in the course of interviewing all of the folks that we interviewed in part of this task force is that currently the Financial Institutions Division is somewhat in the dark ages in relation to the methods that they use and in the manner in which the examinations are conducted, and that there's a lot of room for improvement, things being done more quickly. And I think you can, it's a safe bet based on what we learned in the course of all these interviews, that there was room for at least 50% productivity in what's going on, that by doing the examinations more efficiently and by using computers out in the field to do some of the work that people are now cranking out manually and doing when they go back, we'll be able to increase the productivity of these examiners. The other things that are happening is that as a part of this legislation, we'll be able to share exams with the FDIC and with the federal FISLIC, the one that does the SNLs, right. Anyway, I cannot think of those kinds of things will allow the loss in the number of examiners to be picked up. One of the substantive changes in this bill is to allow the credit union examinations to be conducted every 24 months rather than to require that they be conducted annually. And since the credit unions seem to be the healthier sector of the financial institutions, that's a change that we feel will not be detrimental to the public at all. So I think those things combined will enable us to pick up that slack.
Very creative answer, especially like the way you justified the capital outlay request right off the top. That was, but also part of the answer to Senator Weiner's question would be, well, there's less workload because some banks have closed and some banks have gone to federal charters. So there's a workload decrease that's driven the elimination of a lot of bank examiner positions. Isn't that also true?
That does also contribute to it.
The thing I like least about the answer was the word, used the word only. It seems to me that there ought to be some offering up in a measurable way of increased productivity on the part by the use of people being trained in both insurance and banking. And I would think you could get us that if indeed your plan is going to bear fruit. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that prospectively we can get that information. I'm not sure that we can at this point in time come up with some meaningful figures.
No,
why not? You're going to, you've got a plan now. What you're going to do, you're going to have people moving back and forth and billing back and forth. You should be able to project how you're going to deploy these people if you decide how many you're going to need.
We got too many unknowns in the equation. We don't know how many rate filings we're going to get, et cetera.
More embryology.
More embryology.
EDD.
Mm-hmm. What's not that bad?
You must have a track record on rate filings.
No, we don't have that law now.
Well, you don't have, you've got file in use, so right. You've got the files there.
But I mean, I don't personally know how that's going to translate. I don't know what the economy is going to do. I don't know what NCII is going to do for 88 in terms of a rate increase. It wouldn't be an estimate. It would be a guess.
Well, one other question. Mm-hmm. What about the thing the chair brought up about the banks becoming national banks and closing? Can you give us some figures on how that could be used to justify a reduction of almost a third of the bank examiners?
Senator Weyers, the task force recommendations were based on the worst case scenario. In other words, given the information that's available now as to which banks are in trouble, which may be bought out, which may merge, and we took the worst case scenario on the number of banks that would be available to provide revenue, and then that converts into the number of institutions that you would have left to examine, and so how many examiners that you need. The key piece of information that can give us the answer to your question is missing, and that is, how many person hours does it take to examine an institution of what size? How much time does it really take to examine this institution or that institution? What people do we need at one level? That kind of management information is in the process of being developed, but that void left the task force and therefore this budget request somewhat in the dark in that area. This is our best guess based on all of the information we could get, on talking with people in the FDIC that do examinations, looking at in the best of all possible worlds, what should a bank examiner be able to do, and this is what we were able to come up with.
Why did you take worst case instead of what you thought was an average case of how many banks would be becoming national banks or closing?
Because in the past, the projections and the what has driven this organization has been a too optimistic look at what's been going on. So they've said, gee, if this happens, and if this happens, and maybe we'll get this bank, and we got a phone call from somebody that said they were thinking about coming into Oregon, and they would base budget figures and planning on that kind of information. And those things then didn't come to fruition, and they were left holding the bag, so to speak, to the tune of $1 million of revenue that didn't materialize.
I guess that I'd want to say I accepted that task force recommendation for a set of additional reasons. One, given the health of the state chartered institutions taken as a whole, I cannot, as a matter of judgment, propose fee increases. I mean, I just can't do it. If you want to do it, you can do it, obviously, but I don't want to. And that's a judgment that I've made. That tends to put a limit on what you can do. Mm-hmm. Second, as a matter of personal style and as a matter of guidance from the second floor, we're presenting a conservative budget here. If there's more work out there that we can't do, we'll come in and ask for some help. But I don't. My style is not to build it up and then not use it. You add those two reasons to what the task force recommended, and that's how we got here.
Well, when are you going to come and ask for it? How much problem is it going to take that you see developing? I want to get as much of this as I can on the tape because I don't want to have it be on me.
Yeah, I'm responsible for this, and I recognize it and take the responsibility seriously. It is a tight, lean budget, and if the program gets in trouble, it would be because our best judgment was an error, with the benefit of hindsight.
And you would come to the emergency board as soon as you possibly could.
With some figures, I hope, and some facts, instead of guesswork.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm partly trying to educate myself as I go along here, as well as get a record here. If you say if you're not able to do things, does that mean like if a bank failed next September or October, and when you went in and were looking around in the aftermath, you felt that there wasn't enough examining done, then you'd come back and say, we're afraid this will happen to another bank, maybe we need some more examiners, or what would trouble in the program be, from your definition?
Well, trouble in the program might be success if some people opened some state-chartered financial institutions, or some federals went the other way, or some split-offs occurred, and we had more work on the calendar than we think we have today, we'd be in saying, we got some new business out here. And I would love...
Let's talk about the side that you were going on when you made the decision to cut. That was the worst-case scenario. Where's the worst-case scenario going to bring you back in here to ask for more people? In terms of bank failing, and when something you go in and see afterward.
I really doubt that a bank failure would do it, to be honest with you. And you understand that I'm trying to speak now from a broad management perspective. What would bring me back, and what I hope will bring the new director back, is the judgment of the program. And with the final analysis, you know, you get up in the morning and you got this number, and you got that number, you got this statistic and that, and we can push them around. But you listen to everybody and you consult and you run a team management operation because it's safer and more reliable. And that administrator and that deputy will come in based upon what's going on in the field and say, we can't keep up, and you'll push against that and push against that, and that'll bring us to Ways and Means. But it is a matter of judgment, and there isn't any way to, and I don't want to need to tell you it's something other than that.
Why wouldn't bank closure work?
Because I don't think a failure in this program is the next likely cause. I think there's other causes out there. There's other wounds out there. I mean, it is true, this program could be a cause. A shortage in this program is potentially a cause, but I think that likelihood is remote.
A cause of what?
A bank failure.
Well, I'm talking about a cause of people losing their money, their investments.
Well, because of FDIC and how the feds operate and how the two programs are related, I just don't think that we're going to be the proximate cause, a contributing factor to a failure at this level. And so, I mean, that's why I answered your question. If I'm wrong about that, if anybody ever diagnoses one as stemming from an inability to regulate on time,
what little time I've had to look into this, and I have spent as much as I felt I could. People that I've talked with, people who are involved with the FDIC, and they didn't have any great suggestions on what we ought to do. And frankly, for some reason, seemed very kind of frightened to get involved in this, saying that they were supposed to work on the federal level, and if they messed around on the state level, all kinds of terrible things would happen to them. But they said that it was their view that the state level banking examiners are critical people to protecting depositors when there's trouble in a bank. And that while the federal people are perhaps more important overall, that the state people do have the capacity to get there earlier and to alert, set off an alarm that within the, not within the public that will cause a run on the bank, but within the your outfit to protect depositors.
No question.
And so that's what I'm asking about. I think from what little I know about it, I agree with you that our being there or not may not make a difference between a bank failing or not, but it might make a difference on the protection of depositors. And that's what I'm trying to find out. About it, is there a way that you can reassure me that if there's a situation where it looks like afterward that you could have protected some depositors if you'd had more person power examiners to be in there earlier? And if I'm wrong asking that question, or if you disagree with me asking that question, please say so.
Let's try a couple different ones. Mr. Wace wants to take a shot at it.
Let me take it. Maybe this is a too simple approach to this thing.
Well, could I get an answer to that question from him? He looks like he's ready to answer it.
Okay.
What I move to say, Senator, and I don't mean, it's not facetious at all. I suppose I could raise my comfort level or lower my anxiety level if I had a bank examiner for each bank. You would say to me, on some basis of judgment, that's too many. And if I had none, my anxiety level would become very real. Okay? Someplace in between, you come down and you're responsible for the choice. This is where we come down.
Mr. Weiss?
Mr. Chairman, we've had, I don't know how many of the number of examiners is here, but we've got this number of examiners, and over time, this number hasn't changed all that much. I mean, the positions are there, but you've left them unfilled. They're still there. And at the same time, you've got a declining number of banks that you have to examine. So what they've tried to do is to say, we don't have any good information that tells us how many examiners it takes to do a bank or how long it takes to do it on the average. So we're going to come up with an estimate of the number of examiners we think it takes. Now this line here has got to come down. There is no reason for you to have to feel that you have to justify the continuation of 25 or 28 examiners. So somehow this line is going to come down. It would seem to me what would drive Stan back into you is to say he understands he has to examine an institution once every 24 months, and he's moved from 20 examiners to 10, and if he can't do it every 12 months with 10 examiners, that would, I would think, would be your driving motivation to come back to the emergency board and say, I need some more people. I can't do the examinations that I'm required to do by law, and here's the new information in terms of how many examiners it takes to examine a bank with a given number of assets, the number of days, and so on, and I'm ready to approach you for that. But to try to rationalize why we want to stay at the same number is something you don't need to do. And there are other kinds of things that they've laid on top of you in the sense that you get some work productivity increases by virtue of data processing and some cross-training and things like that. But
you don't have any dates on that line, but as I recall, it was 43 a couple of years ago.
That's 59 last time you saw 57 or 59 last biennium.
So I don't know why in the world you ever drew that line straight.
It's not examiners, though. That's total number of employees.
But the examiners, I'm talking about examiners. Examiners at the dropping too.
Positions
already
are still there, Senator, that aren't filled, see? Okay. And what you're doing is deleting positions that weren't filled in some cases. You're right. The bodies weren't working, but the positions have been there and not filled because they couldn't generate the revenue for it.
Dave Barrows looked like he had something to say on the subject.
Mr. Chairman, Dave Barrows, Oregon League of Financial Institutions. A couple of things that I think it's important for the committee to keep in mind as you sort through this, and I understand the agony that it is for all of you. Senator Wires refers to depositor protection.
Yes.
If a bank fails, or a savings and loan fails, or a credit union fails, as long as the individual doesn't have accounts exceeding $100,000 in that one institution, they're essentially protected. The people that can be in jeopardy if an institution fails are really three: depositors that have more than 100,000, unsecured creditors, and stockholders if it's a stock institution, which not all of them are. So that's who we're really talking about suffering directly, and the communities can suffer and that kind of thing. Secondly, I think it's important, Mr. Chairman, that you be aware that the world operates differently for all for the three major kinds of depository institutions we're talking about. I'm not an expert on credit unions or commercial banks, but as I understand it, in the case of state-chartered credit unions in this state, the federal credit union insurance and regulatory bodies permit the state-chartered credit unions to be examined by the state examiners, and then the state examination is given to the federals, and the federals say, good, that's good enough for us. In the case of commercial banks, the federal, as I understand it, the federal examiners do it 1 year and the state examiners do it the next year. Now, we're only talking about state-chartered institutions here. In the case of state chartered SNLs, the federal examiners come in just as though that institution were a federal institution. They don't care what the state does. One of the reasons we have seen the switches of state chartered savings and loans to the federal charter is that in essence they've had to pay twice. They pay the federal examiner costs and then they pay again to the Fed. And I think it's also important that if you're using bank in the broadest generic term, then you've been accurate. But if you're using bank in the sense of a commercial bank, there are no conversions of commercial banks to a national charter. The only conversions that have occurred in the state are state chartered savings and loans converting to a federal charter. So just a bit of information for whatever value it has to you.
That's good. That is helpful. Thank you very much, Mr. Burroughs. So, well, the reason the feds want to inspect, I suppose, is because they insure the deposits and they have an interest in making sure the operation is, I understand. Okay. Good. Well, I think that may conclude our work. Senator Wires, are you getting near some comfort level?
I've got. Thanks for the time.
Yeah, that's what, no, I appreciate it. This needs some thought. I mean, it's $1 million cut. Out of a $4 million budget, that's.
To answer you, the rest of your question, I'm not very comfortable, but I appreciate you giving me the time to ask the question.
Okay, so we'll same time tomorrow. Thank you very much, everyone. We're adjourned.
Safety of the Joint Ways and Means Committee meeting, May 20th, 1987, 1:30 p.m. through May 2074.
Public Safety Subcommittee Ways and Means will come to order and open a public hearing on House Bill 3381 and call Mr. Paul Romaine representing pawnbrokers. And I do want to correct the record. When I referred the other day to pawnbrokers as fences, I was wrong, and I'm ashamed. It was a terrible thing for me to say because it's really not the licensed pawnbrokers that are the problems. The problem are those little shops that aren't licensed and don't call themselves pawnbrokers that are indeed the fences. So I wanted to offend the right group and not offend the wrong group. Mr. Romaine.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm with the law firm of Preston Thorgerson, Ellis & Holman in Portland. I'm here representing the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association, and I heard your remarks all the way in Portland and quickly got in the car and came down here too late to testify and rebut. But, actually, the pawnbrokers serve a very important function in this world. Basically, they are a lending institution at the basic lower level. They take in goods and loan out money. They hold on to those goods, and then when the money is repaid, the goods go back to the person who brought them in for the money. One of the biggest pawn shop in the state is in Portland. It made about 30,000 to 35,000 loans last year, all of them around $75-$80 average loan. You were talking about people who need quick money for anything, ranging from medical bills to payments, groceries, whatever, and the pawn shop becomes the last legal resort to get to it. In Portland right now, when goods come in, the pawn shop fills out a form that is delivered on a daily basis to the police. That form has the name, address, hopefully telephone number if there is one, driver's license number if there is one, or some form of identification, plus a visual identification. The person is so tall and so much weight, and color eyes, and things like that. That's handed over to the police, and they screen those for any type of property that might be stolen. If the police find the property is stolen, the pawn shop's out that property. They've taken that risk, basically. And I'm glad you mentioned the difference between the pawn shop, the licensed pawn shop, and then the second-hand store out there, which is acting like a pawn shop illegally. Those are the ones who you can run into problems with. I understand a few people on this committee have found their goods at various second-hand shops around the state, I, too, was a victim of a burglary about 5 years ago, and lo and behold, about 2 days later at a second-hand shop, not a pawn shop, second-hand shop, we found the goods. I must say, much to my chagrin, I had already filed my insurance claim, but what the heck. The pawn brokers, we feel the regulation is necessary. You need the uniform state regulation. We did sympathize with the problem that the department has about going after the unlicensed secondhand shop who is acting like a pawnbroker, and we suggested to them that they add to the consumer protection statute found in ORS 646-608. It's the Unlawful Trade Practices Act.
646-608?
Right. A provision in the laundry list of those things that are consumer frauds. A provision that says that if you act as a function like a pawn broker without being licensed, that is a violation of consumer protection laws. That does a number of things. Number one, it provides for the Attorney General's Office, Consumer Protection Division, to go after them. So we give another arm of the state agency, which is used to doing that type of consumer fraud. The second thing it does is it gives a private right of action for that person who happened to have been defrauded to go after them. Both provides for attorney fees, it provides for punitive damages. It's a pretty severe statute. I know I was the chief counsel of the Consumer Protection Division in the Department of Justice back in 1977.
Representative Jones.
Did I hear you say that if you find something that has been stolen and pawned, that you can go claim that, or the police can, and the pawn broker then has to stand the cost of it himself?
Yes.
Well, isn't that different than we discussed yesterday? It was
mm-hmm.
the thought in
it's
mind
different
that you have to go pay for it in order to get it back.
Yeah, I checked out what I thought was a pawn shop, and wasn't. Yesterday I found out they were unlicensed, and they called themselves a jewelry buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, look in the phone book, and it says fast cash, you know. And anyway, the police told me that once the case was settled, then we would have to pay the shop for the items. Now, maybe it's different with pawnbrokers.
Yeah, I know in Portland, they give up the merchandise. They're out.
Is that right?
Yeah. If they have mm-hmm. taken it in and it's not, it's stolen property, it's basically their liability.
Well, then it would be up to the pawnbroker to purchase it or loan money on it with that in mind.
Definitely.
You know, that they got to make a lot of profit someplace along the line in order to pay for giving that back at
right.
their cost or whatever. Of course, they're not doing anything illegal. But the people that stole it,
they're doing something.